It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 40 years ago today, White House counsel John Dean was fired by President Nixon. Dean had already begun to cooperate with the Senate committee investigating the Watergate break-in the year before. His testimony linked Nixon to the scandal that would bring down his presidency. Dean would plead guilty to obstruction of justice in the Watergate cover-up. 4 decades later, Mr. Dean spends much of his time talking to lawyers about legal ethics. He recently visited Pittsburgh, where he spoke at a forum called How Watergate Revolutionized Legal Ethics. Also taking part in the conversation is attorney Jim Robinault, an instructor in legal ethics. I began by asking John Dean to give us the backstory of how he ended up working for the Nixon administration.
Well, you described it as a job of a lifetime. In your early 30s, you don't think of any job as the job of a lifetime. You know you're going to go on and move on. I got there because my predecessors in the job vacated it. John Ehrlichman became assistant to the president for domestic affairs. And John really never gave up the post of counsel of the president. He always really didn't have the title but did have the job. So I, in essence, worked under both Ehrlichman and the White House Chief of Staff, Bob Haldeman. I got there, best I can figure it out, is because the people I worked for at the Department of Justice did not like to go over to the White House and give background briefers to the news media. They found I was pretty good at doing it. I was a quick study, and so they sent me over to do a lot of the background briefing, and that's when I got to know the White House staff. So when Ehrlichman moved up to become assistant for domestic affairs, the president apparently wanted to get some young people into the White House and asked me if I would serve as counsel.
At what point did you first learn of the Watergate break-in?
Well, I happen to have been almost as far away from Washington as you could be. I was in Manila giving a speech, a graduation speech, in the Philippines. First mistake I made was coming home. I learned about it when I landed in San Francisco, called my deputy, and told him I was going to spend, I'd crossed the date line, and that's always kind of a body bender. I literally left the preceding Friday and came back on Monday, having traveled halfway around the world, and so I was going to take a break and spend the day in San Francisco. And he said, no, no, he said, I think you better come home. There's been this problem at this break-in at the DNC, at the Democratic National Committee. So that's when I came home.
And as far as the cover-up, what was your role in it exactly?
Well, it evolved. I'm literally, Paul, right now, for a book that my publishers got me in, going through all the Nixon tapes that deal with Watergate. I always assumed when I took this project on, somebody had already done all of the key tapes and transcribed them. Not so. In fact, they really hadn't even cataloged them. And while there were about 320 partial transcripts by Professor Stanley Cutler, who'd done a book called Abuse of Power, the prosecutors had done about another 80. I found another 600 tapes I don't think anybody outside the archives have ever listened to. So I'm literally, as we're talking, in the process of this work in progress, putting this book together to find out what the president knew and when he knew it. I don't come into play as far as the Oval Office and being recorded until almost 8 months after the break-in. The break-in occurs on June 17th of 1972. It's really not until late February and March that I start dealing with him on a regular basis on Watergate. I have one meeting in September that I visit with him, but it really is, it's not conclusive of much of anything other than to me at the time that the president was very aware of the cover-up. So what's my role? I'm working for Haldeman and Ehrlichman, and I evolve into what I described as the linchpin because I can deal with both Haldeman and Ehrlichman, who are my superiors, and my former boss, the Attorney General, John Mitchell, who was running the campaign at the time of the Watergate break-in, and he'll resign. And so I become the liaison between all these different parties. And that's how I got myself in the middle of it all.
You had a sense that you were going to be made the scapegoat at some point.
That's pretty late in the game, and that's when everything has fallen apart. At one point in the spring, early spring, in mid-March, after I've been dealing with the president for a while, I don't think that he really appreciates and understands the implications of what he's doing. He's trying to get me to write a bogus report that he has announced earlier that I've conducted an investigation I have not conducted and cleared everybody when I have not conducted such an investigation. So at one point I go in March, and it became something of a famous conversation and recorded conversation because I told Nixon there was a cancer on his presidency and began telling him all the problems he had. It was after that that I pretty effectively removed myself from the cover-up and watched everybody else scramble because I was unwilling to play the game at that point. And when, to me, it was really not terribly relevant whether I had executive privilege or immunity or any of these things. I had decided what I was going to do come what may, although my attorney thought otherwise. At one point, the president was preparing a statement on what everybody on the White House staff would do, and they slipped into the statement a fact that nobody from the White House would be given immunity. Well, that just sent me a real clear signal that they were trying to force me to shut up and be quiet and disappear. And that's when I issued a statement saying, listen, the only time I ever talked to the press in that whole time, until well after Watergate, and I had my secretary read a statement to a couple of the news outlets just saying if anyone, it was a good way to communicate with my staff at that point, that my superiors, that if anybody thought I was going to be a scapegoat, they didn't understand me.
Just to clarify things for our listeners, what exactly were you guilty of?
Well, the obstruction of justice is not what you'd call a bright-line crime, nor is conspiracy to obstruct justice a bright-line crime. That's what we do a lot of time and spend a lot of effort trying to use this history for currently practicing attorneys, because the rules of professional conduct changed directly as a result of Watergate. And lest anybody make the kind of mistakes I made as a young lawyer, we go out and share a lot of these historical instances showing what would happen if you took the rules that are in existence today and applied them to those events in history. And turns out to be a very good teaching tool. So what we really do is tell people the kind of problem you can get into, give them a historical heads up, and then show how the rules work today that can help you avoid those kinds of situations.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with John Dean, who is a former White House counsel and currently a lecturer and an author as well as a businessman. How have the events surrounding Watergate forever changed professional conduct standards for lawyers?
That's one of the few things that did have a lasting change out of Watergate. Post-Watergate, there were a lot of reforms. There was campaign finance reform. That's all pretty well dissolved because of the Supreme Court decisions in Buckley versus Viejo and Citizens United and other major cases that have all but placed very limited restrictions on campaign finance. So that changed. In the aftermath, there was the creation of a special prosecutor's office, which indeed caused a lot of other presidents' problems from just right in succession. Bill Clinton, most famously, with Ken Starr. But that law has now had a sunset provision, and after both sides were sufficiently gored by that, they let it expire. That was actually the number one recommendation of the Senate Watergate Committee, was to create an Office of Independent Counsel. So that's gone. I think a lot of the campaign laws have really changed. There was a post-Watergate morality, if you will, for a number of years. Certainly, investigative journalism has changed dramatically. And that, again, is because of the Internet and the fact that there's a lot of corporate ownership of so many news outlets today, which were not true. The relationship of the media with the president has really changed as well. Presidents used to be given, pre-Watergate, pretty much the benefit of the doubt. Now they're pretty well assumed guilty until they prove themselves innocent. But that's generally true of most public figures today, and largely because of Watergate. So the changes are most conspicuous with the bar, which said we're going to require all lawyers to have ethical training and standards of professionalism with renewal annually as to requirements and what have you. So this helps to keep the professional lawyers on the mark, and as I say, it's an opportunity for someone like myself to share some bad stories about what can go wrong.
What kind of a difference would it have made if tougher disclosure rules for attorneys had been in place before the Watergate crimes occurred?
I don't know that it – there were different lawyers involved in different ways, and some of it was competency, which is one of the first rules was probably violated. There were really a lot of ignorance about the criminal law. No one was watching for conspiracy to obstruct justice. They were dealing with a political problem. When you get to things like purge, that's pretty black and white. When you get to things like breaking in and bugging the DNC, that's pretty black and white. The lawyers who were involved in those things really were not in a vague area. It's really those who weren't intentionally setting out to commit crimes that the CLE, the Continuing Legal Education Program, is focused on. The long and short of it is that lawyers make very human mistakes, and in today's climate, it's just as easy to do it as it was 40 years ago.
And so you're doing a legal education seminar on Watergate here in Pittsburgh.
I am. I'm doing one for the Allegheny County Bar.
One of the things that you're looking at is the whole issue of attorney-client privilege. And one question that comes to mind is, how is the attorney-client privilege and confidentiality tested when an organization of any kind engages in wrongdoing?
That's a wonderful lead for my partner, who is Jim Robinault, one of the world's great experts on this subject. And I'm going to defer to him and let Jim answer that question for you.
This is the essence of what we teach. The question that people have is, if a lawyer learns that their client in an organization is engaged in crime or fraud, and it's ongoing, and there's going to be future impact, what's their obligation? We all have this duty of confidentiality, just like a priest listening to a confession. The reason we have the confidentiality is to get the full story. And so we don't want people to think that lawyers will become whistleblowers if they hear the full story. However, if there's going to be ongoing impact, then you have other people you have to consider. You know, the people who are going to be impacted by that. And the rules changed because of John's testimony during Watergate. When he said all these lawyers were involved, everybody sat there, didn't say anything. He eventually breaks ranks and does do it. And the rules did not allow that back then. Today, the rules allow a lawyer, if there's going to be ongoing crime, like an Enron situation, where you're learning about fraud that's going to impact investors in the future, lawyers can say to their clients, stop what you're doing or I may have to report you. It's a wonderful thing for lawyers in the sense it gives them leverage with their client, whereas in the past, they would just have to resign and not say anything. So it's a big change in law, big change for lawyers, and it really goes back to Watergate 40 years ago. These rules only were changed in the last decade. Including here in Pennsylvania. So it's a big change for lawyers.
It gives the lawyers the chance to be whistleblowers.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't encourage them to do so.
Right.
There are all sorts of constraints around it. But if there's going to be future impact from crime or fraud, you're measuring, you know, that impact versus keeping quiet. And it's better, the profession now thinks, for lawyers to be able in limited circumstances to report if they can't stop their client from doing bad things. Now, in an organization, you have to report up the ladder before you do that. Get all the way to the board of directors. Presumably, if you do that and you're saying there's fraud going on or crime and they ignore it, they do so at their peril and you can go outside the organization. The main idea is to take care of it within the organization, if at all possible, before going outside, to stop it within the organization. It's kind of what happened at the Penn State scandal, frankly. We teach that as one of our examples.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you one last question. You were disbarred as a result of Watergate. Why didn't you pursue reinstatement of your law license?
Well, a number of those who were lawyers and lost their license because of Watergate have gotten them back. I just never chose to. I haven't still ruled out the possibility, it's something I just didn't need. I went into business and didn't plan to practice law, so there was no sense in going through the procedure. And I also thought, you know, with the passage of time, we look at it with a lot more perspective today than we did, say, even 10 or 15 years after, when most of the guys who went back and got their licenses did it like 3 to 5 years afterwards, which was still a pretty hot subject then. I actually testified for a number of them and tried to shed some light where I could.
Former White House counsel, businessman, author, and lecturer John Dean is in Pittsburgh and has been my guest. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Pleasure, Paul. This is a neighborhood I really come from, in a sense, since my mother and father met in Pittsburgh. My father was at Carnegie, and my mother was at what was then Pennsylvania College for Women, and is now Chatham. And I probably wouldn't be here had they not met.
Well, we're awfully glad you're here and here again.
Thank you.
Coming up, whether you're a recreational jogger or a serious runner taking part in this weekend's Pittsburgh Marathon, business contributor Rebecca Harris discusses the business of running shoes. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and you're listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.